What do you make of a novelist whose work touches on science fiction, the Holocaust, Lawrence of Arabia, and the Old West? A novelist who had a thriving career teaching gross anatomy before turning to fiction? A novelist who can curse like a sailor and yet capture the voice of a prim schoolteacher so fully, you'd swear the character must be based on her. We're talking about Mary Doria Russell, whose work includes sci-fi, historical fiction, and a murder mystery, making her, in her own words, a literary genre slut. Hey, she said it.
I did.
Not me.
I did.
Her new novel is set in Egypt during the 1921 Cairo Peace Conference, a pivotal event in the creation of the modern Middle East. Her somewhat unlikely protagonist, a mild-mannered Ohio woman traveling with her trusty dog by her side, Mary Doria Russell joins us in studio to discuss that character's journey from Cleveland to Cairo and her own journey from the world of science to the world of literature. Her latest is called Dreamers of the Day. Her previous books include The Sparrow and A Thread of Grace. Mary Doria Russell, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Many reviewers labeled your first two books science fiction. Your third and fourth are historical fiction, and you're currently working on a murder mystery set in the Old West. Are you trying to incite some kind of literary anarchy?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I just do what's fun. I started calling myself a genre slut about a year ago when I realized that I would stand on the literary corner and I'll get into any genre that goes by and offers to take me to a good party.
Indeed she has. Your academic background is in biological anthropology. As we mentioned, you taught human gross anatomy. Were you one of those scholars who secretly always had a desire to write fiction?
No. Actually, the first fiction I ever tried was The Sparrow, unless you count grant proposals. I was a classically trained anthropologist in four fields, linguistics, social anthropology, archaeology, and biological anthropology, and I was good at what I did. But I got fed up with academe, which is how I like to put it, that I lost my job.
You know, they say the politics in academe are so vicious because the stakes are so low.
Absolutely. That's, I believe that entirely, yes. So it turned out to be a good career move for me.
You know, it seems that fiction and anthropology are both about the study of human behavior. How has your academic training impacted the way you approach your role as a storyteller?
Oh, well, sometimes it's direct, as it was with The Sparrow, where I was drawing on the experiences that I had had being dropped into a different culture and having to cope with new languages and just kind of learning things on the fly, trying to come up to speed very quickly in somebody else's world. With my fifth novel, the one that the Western, I'm going to be writing, it's about Doc Holliday. And he was a very good dentist. I used to teach gross anatomy at a dental school, so I have a great appreciation for his professional background. But what it really does is it makes, to be an anthropologist is to know when you don't know. Or at least to be, you might not get it immediately, but you're alert to the fact that you may not know what you're talking about and should probably check it out before you say anything.
Which brings me to the Cairo Peace Conference, because that's not exactly cocktail hour conversation for most Americans, and
yeah,
it's really an area of when you find out what you don't know, because
yes,
here comes Osama bin Laden, and he mentions 1921.
No, what he said, it was 2001 when he was taking credit for the attacks on 9/11, and he mentioned that it was partly in to avenge the catastrophe of 80 years ago. And I heard that.
And wait a minute, when she heard it, she was thinking of taking a year off.
Yes. I was going to take a year off to rest up and read for pleasure. I lasted 36 hours. But I did the math, and I thought, well, okay, World War I ended in 1918. The Versailles Peace Conference was 1919. What happened in 1921 drew a complete blank. But I was working on A Thread of Grace, and it wasn't until 4 years later that I came across a biography of T.E. Lawrence and came to the Cairo Peace Conference, and that was 1921. I went, oh, do the math. That's the 80 years ago. So it's clearly a live issue in the Middle East, and it's something that Americans simply do not remember.
You know, I think of the Berlin Conference of 1885, 1886 that divided up Africa that is still fresh in the memories.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Of people who live in that part of the world. And you've pointed out that a lot of people in the Arab world still remember the significance of the Cairo Peace Conference and feel a lot of bitterness about it. And I often think that that's because we are from a young culture. Those people are from a much older culture. Were you trying to make a
When we say in this culture, when we say, well, that's just history. We're dismissing it as no longer of any importance. History is a big deal in a lot of other cultures.
Because there's thousands and thousands of years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Were you trying to make a comment on the current relationship between the West and Middle Eastern nations? Should
Gosh,
we think of 1921?
I'm wearing, I don't know if you can see it from where you're sitting, and certainly the people who are listening can't see this, but I'm wearing copies of my of the dog tags of my nephew, Tim Ryman. Lieutenant Ryman is commanding a platoon of Marines in Alis, which is on the Euphrates, just southwest of Baghdad. And there is a direct historical line between the decisions that were made in 1921 by a handful of British imperialists and the fact that Tim's little boy learned to walk and had his first birthday and said his first words while his daddy was in Iraq.
Because it was that 1921 conference that created Iraq.
Yes, exactly. A lady named Lady Gertrude Bell drew a line around Mosul, Basra, and Baghdad and called it Iraq. And Winston Churchill thought that was a swell idea because he, like Donald Rumsfeld, was trying to control this region on the cheap. And he thought, oh, good, well, we won't have to, if we put the Kurds and the Shia and the Sunni together, we won't have to administer it in triplicate. That's, you know, these are the kinds of decisions that were being made. And Arnold Wilson, a man who was at that conference, said, you're going to have at least 300,000 troops on the ground in order to control this region, and what you're doing is never going to work. And here we are, still trying. That same mistake echoes down the 85 years now.
I've read that you consider Dreamers of the Day to be your most autobiographical novel and that you used it to untangle some of the complexities in your relationship with your mother.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, a lot of the – this is not a question I've had to answer yet.
Good.
So you're hitting me for the first time with this. My mother had many fine qualities. But warmth and affection were not among them. And I wanted to see, this was in some sense a sort of thought experiment. I wanted to look at how my mother was raised. And so I had to go back to her mother. Whenever I write a character, I always need to know what their parents were like, what history the parents lived through, in order to be able to judge how my character was brought up. And in the same way that the baby boom of America was influenced by the child-rearing ideas of Dr. Spock, my mother's mother's generation was influenced by a Dr. Holt, who said that mother love was a corrosive and corrupting influence that should be ripped out of the hearts of any woman who raised a child because you could only hurt your children by showing them any form of affection at all. That echoes down the generations.
Well, can you elaborate a little bit, therefore, about the similarities and dissimilarities between yourself and the protagonist in this book, Agnes?
Oh, well, probably the most important difference was the influence of my father in my childhood because he was affectionate, and I got all the approval and attention and affection that I needed from him. Agnes doesn't have that. She has this desire to be ruled by her mother and to please her mother, and there simply isn't any pleasing this woman. it's not going to happen, Agnes, which is what her brother tells her. You know, give
but
it
you,
up.
But both you and Agnes live in Ohio. You both own and love dachshunds.
Well, yes, but that was also in having done A Thread of Grace just before I did this book. A Thread of Grace took me 7 years. That was about the about Jewish survival in Nazi-occupied Italy, and I had interviewed elderly people who had been rescuers and survivors, and it was real heavy going for a long, long time. And so I was looking at something where I just for 10 years I had been asking myself, you know, would it actually kill you to write about, you know, something that you know about? You know? Because I never write what I know. I love the research. So I thought, you know, maybe a middle-aged lady from Ohio. Could you just try it? So you didn't have to, like, look up what was blooming in April in Cleveland because you just have to look out the window. Just give it a shot. So everybody speaks English in this book.
Well, for her, the research has often been the thing. We're talking with Mary Doria Russell, author of her latest novel, Dreamers of the Day. You named your main character Agnes Shanklin after one of your teachers.
Yes.
Can you talk about why that teacher was a source of inspiration?
Yeah, Agnes Shanklin was my freshman English teacher in high school in Lombard, Illinois. And she was, in 1964, when I was taking freshman English, close to retirement age. She was a tiny little lady. I'm not big, but she only came up to my shoulder. And she wore her gray hair in a classic 1920s bob. When you're 14, you're under this impression that people have always been the age they are when you meet them. You know, so Miss Shanklin was always a nice little old lady. And occasionally, she taught us all how to diagram sentences, and, you know, so great. Everything I've done since 1965 has been based on the skills that I got from Agnes Shanklin. But every once in a while, she would just let loose this incendiary political opinion that would just come out of her mouth like a solar flare.
And, of course, at 14 years old, you couldn't figure out where that came
from. Yeah, and so I did the math on her again, and I went, oh, my God, Miss Shanklin must have been a teenager during the Roaring Twenties. And I just suddenly got a whole different notion of what this lady was all about. And that kind of stuck in my mind for a long time. And so when I was looking for someone who would be my window into the 1920s, Agnes Shanklin came to mind.
And, of course, she will be a window into your own past, because as soon as other people who were instructed by Agnes Shanklin start reading this book,
absolutely,
you're going to get phone calls and emails.
That's right. I'm going out to Chicago. I'll be there in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait to see to meet people who remember Agnes Shanklin. Yes.
We're going
to
take a short break. When we come back, we'll ask Mary Doria Russell to read a little bit from Dreamers of the Day. Her previous books include The Sparrow and A Thread of Grace. By the way, if you'd like to have a conversation with Mary Doria Russell, you can call us at 800-433-8850. Dorian Esmond has nothing else to do. 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nambi. Welcome back. We're talking with novelist Mary Doria Russell, whose previous books include The Sparrow and The Thread of Grace. Her newest historical novel is called Dreamers of the Day. And in this case, your protagonist, Agnes Shanklin, arrives in Egypt, meets some larger-than-life characters like Lawrence of Arabia and Winston Churchill, and apparently does one of those pip, pip, over to Dover, bend the elbow deals with Winston Churchill.
Well, Winston Churchill has invited Agnes out. He has gone to paint the pyramids, and she gets caught in this anti-British riot because everywhere he goes, people want to kill him. And it was quite terrifying. And as they get back to the hotel, he has decided to, she must come in and have a drink with everyone, you know. So for the next few hours, Winston kept my drink topped up during the general merriment he made of our adventure. I was briefly aware that he was eliminating the emptying glass that might have warned me of overindulgence. Very soon it didn't seem to matter. I rather liked the taste of gin and tonic and began to feel quite gay. The terror of the riot was swept aside by conviviality, and everyone was being so nice to me. For the first time in my life, I began to understand why people enjoy drinking. Barriers are dissolved. Conversation is easy and unexamined. Nothing you say seems stupid, and everything seems amusing. No wonder gin parties were all the rage back home. I had the vague impression that Lawrence was keeping an eye on me. While I do not remember getting into the taxi with him, I do recall his tolerant chivalry when I warned him that I was probably going to be sick. The colonel snapped an order to the driver, who pulled to the side of the road halfway over the Gezira Bridge. Lawrence got out, opened my door, and steadied me on the way to the railing, where I abruptly contributed to the general fetidness of the Nile. "Oh, dear Lord," I gasped, hilarious and horrified as I took the handkerchief that Lawrence offered. "I just puked in front of the uncrowned King of Arabia." "My dear Miss Shanklin," Lawrence said with a gallantry I have never forgotten, "I was an undergraduate at Oxford, believe me. I've seen worse."
Mary Doria Russell, reading from Dreamers of the Day. Allow me to go to the telephones. Here's Paris in Manassas, Virginia. Paris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning or afternoon. First of all, Kojo, I'd like to say you have a really wonderful show. And Mary, I have read The Sparrow and loved it.
Thank you.
And I'm listening to this. T. Lawrence is a tremendous hero of mine. And I totally agree with the lack of understanding with the Middle East and Iraq. These are people who started out as tribesmen, and somebody decided to make them a country.
Yes, well, that was Lady Gertrude Bell who thought it was a good idea. Lawrence had probably a more pragmatic way of dealing with this. In a lot of ways, the decision makers at the 1921 Cairo conference were kind of mapped pretty directly onto more recent American leaders. If you think of Winston Churchill as Donald Rumsfeld, you're not far wrong. They are articulate, can be quite charming, and almost incapable of imagining they might be wrong about anything. In Condi Rice, you have the Lady Gertrude Bell figure, immensely knowledgeable, included in a lot of the planning, but then cut out of the loop when push came to shove. With Lawrence, it's almost like Colin Powell, where these were military men who were pressed into service in what amounts to the State Department and got badly outmaneuvered and then disappeared from public life almost directly afterwards, not being terribly thrilled with how their influence was used in ways that they didn't anticipate. So it's really, there are a lot of echoes of 1921.
Fascinating analogy. This email is simply from someone who describes him or herself as a fan. Your guest has incredible insights on culture. What way does she think the United States could use an understanding of different cultures, such as the many in Iraq, to help cultural understanding? Would this be just a cultural exercise, or could we make a difference for people in Iraq and many other countries? Would she like to be Secretary of Anthropology in the next, in the next president's cabinet?
Well, what's interesting is that right now, the first lieutenants and the captains who are stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq are finding out that what helps them the most is an understanding of the local culture, the language, the way that the power structure works, the internal pressures that work on people in Iraq and Afghanistan. The more they know about that, the more effective they are as military people. And that, I believe, is being codified by General Petraeus. And it's been said that when this generation of captains and first lieutenants come to higher command, that anthropology and an appreciation for the places where you have to operate will become more commonly taught and rewarded.
I guess that'll be one of the lessons we have learned from this adventure.
Oh, if we learn any lessons at all.
Here's Dick in Potomac, Maryland.
Too old to think we're going to learn any lessons.
Dick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, it's a little noisy. It's the background noise from my car. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I shouldn't be talking on the phone. I wondered.
You shouldn't be driving. Pull over.
I wondered if you had read the book by someone whose first name is Heinz, but his last name is lost to me, who was a German Jew born in 1920. In what was the capital of Prussia called Breslau.
What would be the relevance of that to what we're discussing
now? The book covers the history of the world since 1920.
Oh.
And basically it's important because you must recognize that in the 1920, the Germans had an empire in Africa as well as other places. And he's concerned with a lot of the things associated with any of the countries who had pieces of an empire in different places. So he does cover, in fact, France, Italy,
Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium,
all of whom had colonies all over the world.
Right.
And he's concerned that, and he's a historian. I'm sorry I can't get you his last name.
Well, that's okay. I know that I haven't read that one, but I will tell you that I agree that although we like to think of ourselves as terribly modern and in charge of our world, I think that the more you know about the history starting in the 1850s, the more aware you are that we are simply unwinding the imperial past and the colonial past of Europe. Borders that are in dispute today on every continent come directly out of decisions and warfare that went on under Imperial Europe.
Do you think we tend to be in denial about that?
Sure. Yeah. We're in denial about anything that requires us to look at something beyond American Idol.
I wish I had you here for a longer time. Your last book, A Thread of Grace, dealt with the heroism of Italians who tried to help Jews escape the Holocaust. I've read that you
And did so. Actually, and did so. Yeah, 85% survival, the highest survival rate in occupied Europe.
But because of that, I guess I've read that you were afraid of creating a feel-good Holocaust novel. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, you know, when we will tend to defend ourselves from our own anxieties by identifying with either survivors or rescuers, because we don't like to think of ourselves as being the ones who were thrown into the pit, and we don't like to think of ourselves as one of the 500 million people who found very good reasons not to help Jews during World War II. So there is this temptation to either believe that you would have been helped or to believe that you would have helped. And statistically, that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
So I wrote two-thirds of that book, and my son and I, and without knowing who was going to live and who was going to die at the end of the book, my son and I made a list of the characters and flipped a coin: heads they lived, tails they died. Because everybody I talked to told me it was blind dumb luck whether you lived or died. It wasn't if you were clever. It wasn't if you were brave. It wasn't, none of those things mattered. It was dumb luck, and that's what we put into that novel. Was
I think I'll allow Jerry in Westminster, Maryland to have the last word. Jerry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. I've actually read the book. I got a reader's copy of it.
Dreamers of the Day, huh?
Yes. And I absolutely loved it.
Oh, good.
And
go into a bookstore. Say that real loud for me, okay?
I'll buy copies for friends, okay?
Good for you. Thank you.
What did you like most about it, Jerry?
I loved the main character. I loved the fact that I was never quite sure what was going to happen, but I was totally absorbed in it. And I wanted to know how you got, I mean, I felt like I was in the 20s. I felt like I knew these people. And can you talk a bit about how you did that?
In the 10 seconds she has left.
Yes, research. I have to know everything about my characters.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Jerry, thank you very much for your call. Mary Dory Russell, thank you very much for joining us. Mary Dory Russell's latest novel is called Dreamers of the Day. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nambi.